Coane. The trial of the Scottsboro boys, falsely accused of raping two white women back in 1931, became a cause célèbre. They were strangers riding on a train looking for work during the Depression when a dangerous lie changed their lives. The nine African Americans aged 13 to 19 were arrested, tried, and found guilty a number of times before all white juries in a travesty of justice. The Philadelphia Theater Company has brought their story to life in the musical The Scottsboro Boys. It's being performed at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Center City, Philadelphia through February 19th. The musical uses the minstrel show form to dramatic and moving effect. The music and lyrics are by the legendary team of John Kander and the late Fred Ebbs. One of the actors and the librettist joins us today on Radio Times. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Forrest McLennan. He plays several parts in this musical, including the role of Mr. Tambo, for which he received a Tony nomination. And Forrest McLennan, what a pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And on the telephone is David Thompson, the librettist of the Scottsboro Boys. He has collaborated with the musical theater legendary duo of Kander and Ebb on a number of productions, and he joins us by telephone. And David Thompson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here. And I have to say, I saw the production yesterday, and it is really fantastic. And if I could start with you, David Thompson, and I was listening to some of the discussion after yesterday's performance, and you talked about the creation of this musical, and it seemed to happen around Fred Ebb's kitchen table. Take us back, I guess, 10 years, and how this musical came to life.
Yeah, Fred Ebb... And John Kander are incredible collaborators. They really know how to get an idea up off the ground, and they sort of invented the idea and held that in the way they've developed all of their musicals. They become very much a collaboration among the writer, the director, and themselves. And so there we were sitting at that table, and we knew we wanted to do a project. We had worked together in the past. We were determined to find a project to work together on again. And Susan Stroman said, who's the choreographer and the director of the piece, said, let's find a real story. Let's find a true story to tell. Because so often in the musical theater, you find yourself telling more fantastical stories. Mm-hmm. Either, you know, you're off in the plains of Oklahoma or you're in, you know, in London, England. But we thought, let's tell a true American story. And we started looking at different trials. And then in particular, this one, we were drawn to it almost immediately because so much of it still resonates today. It's still something that really speaks to a lot of people on a lot of different levels. And ironically, it's a story that has been more or less forgotten.
Yeah.
So it was something we wanted to explore, and we set off. And like any project, you don't really know where you're going to go when you start, but we knew we were at the right place.
And I do want to pick up on some of that story, but Forrest, let me get you in on the conversation. Again, you play several roles, including this Mr. Tambo. What was your interest in this production? Why did you want to be in this musical?
Well, I think two things. First, the idea of taking a chapter from our racial history and putting that story on stage was really important to me. I'm an educator, and for me, theater really is a great platform for educating. Secondly, it was being able to tell the story in this particular form, using the minstrel form, which I'd been exposed to in a couple of other productions. I had performed the role of the street singer in blackface at the Wilma Theater back in 1998. So the idea of being able to play one of these end men. In a traditional minstrel show, you have 13 players. In the center, there is an interlocutor, and on either end, there are two end men who not only tell jokes and interact with the master of ceremonies, but are responsible for moving the narrative forward. So we play a number of different men that have a significant impact on the boys' lives on that particular journey.
Shall we say, you're choosing your words very carefully there. And I have to say, before I saw it, I thought, you know, how do you tell this tragic and serious story through the sort of, you know, vaudeville minstrel show idea? And were you in any way sort of scratching your head about that for us as well, which is, how do you make this work?
Absolutely not. I think I knew instantaneously that the form would really support telling this particular story because it's such a sad story, such a difficult story, and I knew the form would allow us to use to inject humor in a loving way that would allow us to present the story in its overwhelming injustice in a palatable way.
Well, and David Thompson, in many ways, it turns many things on its head, including you have black male actors who are playing the two white women who charged rape. I mean, just as an audience member to kind of have your head turned around as you watch this on stage.
Well, it was interesting. The minstrel form, it's a terrible art form. The ironic part about it is it was America's original art form. And for about 100 years, it was really one of the leading ways people were entertained in a lot of areas in the country. Of course, it's based on a terrible racial injustice that's built into the fabric of it. But it is very American. That's where a lot of our popular music came from. And still today, there's a lot of ways that form still is still evident. But what was interesting about it was we took the form and then we turned it on its head. We had that idea, typically in a minstrel format, it's either white men playing black men in blackface or black men wearing blackface, but it was still always, it had very specific rules, but we tipped it on its head so that it was allowed the African-American actors to play the white characters, to lampoon the white characters, whether you were dealing with the girls who cried rape, the lawyers, the guards, the different people that they would come in contact with, and then they began to lampoon it. And what was interesting was, it allowed us the ability to almost put a mask up and have the freedom to do anything we wanted to do. We could go anywhere we needed to go. And it suddenly opened it up. And at the same time, it took a very racially charged art form and really collided it with a very racially charged story. And I think it helps amplify it. It helps take that message up one more notch in a frightening way so that you have to listen to everything again for the first time, because a lot of the things that happen to these boys, we've gotten used to, and either we've forgotten about, or when we hear it, it's hard for it to resonate again in the same way that it should. So it actually was very freeing, a terrible art form, but it was actually something that that we just pushed forward with.
Go ahead, Forrest.
And what I think was so helpful about it is that it makes the boys the heroes in this particular case.
That's right.
It creates a circus-like atmosphere around them that really puts the focus back on the true heroes in, as I said, who, as a result of their imprisonment, really changed all of our lives.
And apparently, David, from some of the news accounts of that time, the news reporters used the minstrel idea. That was one way that this story was told at that time, through this notion of minstrelsy.
Well, and it's interesting, not unlike any court trials that we've had in America, they oftentimes become celebrity circuses or circuses about injustice. And at the time, they would talk about the Scottsboro Boys being treated, either in the Northern press, being treated as if they were in a minstrel format, or even just talk the way that they were sort of portrayed in the press as part of this legacy of minstrelsy in America. So it was an interesting, when we saw that, we read that, in fact, there was an article about that in the American Historical Review about the rhetoric of the case, and they talked specifically about that, and when that came up, that notion that even during that time, they were aware of this having a very minstrel-like circus atmosphere, we thought that's interesting because that was something that was identified at that time, and suddenly, you know, it became even that much, it had that much more resonance.
How much research, Forrest, did you do in not just the parts that you play, but also this piece of history back in the 1930s?
Quite a lot. The moment I read the script, the first thing I went and did was got the autobiography of Rosa Parks, so I got to have a better understanding of that particular connection in terms of our story. But then, as an actor, what made it really exciting is that it includes playing everything from high caricature, yes, to almost Chekhovian realism, and it includes playing fictionalized characters as well as real characters. And so people like Samuel Leibowitz, I had
the lawyer in the case.
Yes.
Defending the Scottsboro Boys.
Indeed. I had to research him as if I were playing an O'Neill, as if I were playing him in a very realistic fashion, and then heighten him using minstrel tools, if you will.
Well, and it's interesting watching you, frankly, and the other actors, but you in particular, is the body language that you use as you inhabit these characters, as you walk across the stage, how your facial expressions change, your dialect changes.
The beauty of really working on it is that it allows really big vocal choices, really big physical choices. In fact, the bigger the better, because it allows for a lot of distinction, which I think is critical for allowing the audience to take the ride on the story. So it was just a lot of fun to do, and Susan Stroman was so encouraging.
And are what we're seeing, is that vaudeville, is that minstrelsy, is that what we're seeing on stage then?
Absolutely. And the greatest research for it for me really was watching cartoons.
Oh, is that right?
Again, you have to just have really, really... Bugs Bunny is a champ.
Yes, he was. Now that I think about it, yes, that makes a lot of sense.
Really, really big choices.
David Thompson, the name Rosa Parks came up, and she is a almost silent character in this musical, but nonetheless a very powerful presence. What was her association to the Scottsboro Boys?
Well, it's interesting. Rosa Parks, when we wrote the story, we knew that we needed to give it a forward motion. And when you look at the story of the Scottsboro Boys, it's not a clean ending. So many of those boys either remained in jail, their lives led to places where they weren't necessarily either remembered or recognized, and a lot of them met with tragedy. And we wanted to be able to move the story forward, and Susan Stroman had the idea to find a quiet observer for the piece, where we could, through that character's eyes, see things happening and moving forward. And for a long time, in some of the early drafts, it was a young girl who was actually observing this. But when we looked at it, the history of it, we stumbled across a very interesting and remarkable piece of history that Rosa Parks, in 1931, when she was 19 years old, marched to free the Scottsboro Boys. And during that march, she met her husband, Raymond Parks. And then together, a year later, they would be married, and they would become very involved with the Scottsboro Boys in a lot of different ways through the early days of the NAACP in Alabama. And she was actually, while the men, Raymond and other men in that chapter would be finding ways to raise money to continue to help awareness and with the trials for the Scottsboro Boys, she would sit on the front porch of their house in order to watch out for any trouble that might happen or any problems that would come, because, of course, a group of black men gathering to find ways to raise money for the Scottsboro Boys could have really caused an enormous amount of trouble. What was interesting, though,
Well, you know what, David, if you don't mind, just hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break and we're going to get back to our conversation. We are talking about the Scottsboro Boys. It's a musical. It's here at the Suzanne Roberts Theater, talking with David Thompson and Forrest McClendon. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and we do want to play some music as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, a Philadelphia Orchestra showpiece, Rimsky-Korsakov's spectacular Scheherazade, under guest conductor Nicola Luisotti, plus Shostakovich's first violin concerto with Nadia Salerno-Sonnenberg. For your tickets, 215-893-1999, online at philorc.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Scheherazade with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
I'm Marty Moscowain. It's the winter membership campaign here at WHYY. If you're a new listener, if you've never been a supporter, or your membership has lapsed, please take a few minutes and make a pledge of support to WHYY. That phone number is 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. On Radio Times, we find the guests, we host the conversations. Make a call, 1-888-345-9499. Thank you very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. We are talking about the creation of the Scottsboro Boys, a new musical that's here in Philadelphia, and also talking with one of the actors in the musical. But I do want to play a song, I should say, before we get back to our conversation from the original Broadway cast recording of the Scottsboro Boys, and it's called Commencing in Chattanooga, actually featuring Brandon Victor Dixon as Haywood Patterson and company. Let's listen.
Commencing in Chattanooga, commencing in Chattanooga, on the Southern Railroad line, on the Southern Railroad line.
Come on, Roy, grab on!
Where we going, Andy?
Who cares? Just don't follow!
I got up in the morning when my sleep was done, and I felt that cheery Chattanooga sun. Then I thanked the Lord above that I was still alive as I waited for the 6:05.
Commencing in Chattanooga,
and it chugga-chuggered in, and I said, there you are, as I scrambled in the old boxcar. Then I settled back, believing that the world was fine. I was traveling on the Southern line.
Commencing in Chattanooga, on the Southern Railroad line.
Now you can take your piano, and you can take your Santa Fe, and you can take your old Rock Island line,
and throw them all away.
If the Pennsylvania calls to say you want your money back, and if the New York Central's on the phone,
tell them they're way off the track. Commencing in Chattanooga, commencing in Chattanooga. I said we're commencing in Chattanooga. On the
and again, a song from the Scottsboro Boys called Commencing in Chattanooga. Forrest McClendon is with us here in our Philadelphia studios, and he is performing in the Scottsboro Boys here in Philadelphia. Actually was nominated for a Tony for his role of Mr. Tambo, and joining us by telephone is David Thompson, wrote the book for the Scottsboro Boys, and we are talking about, as I said, the creation of this musical, and also talking about what it's like to perform in it. And I wonder, David Thompson, if we could actually go back to 1931. That's a song about these strangers, essentially, that meet on a train. It's 1931. It's the Depression. They are looking for work, and they are accused of raping two white women back in 1931. That has got to be a very dangerous charge.
Yeah, it's interesting. The boys were on the train. There were a lot of different people on the train. There's a whole culture, practically, of young Americans who grew up on the trains during that part of the Depression. And that kind of hoboing was something people had to do in order to survive. And these boys were on that train. Either they were looking for work, trying to get to the river to get to Memphis, or they were coming back from places where they couldn't find work and just trying to get home. So they were on this train. And these two women, two young girls, who were on the train for the same reasons. They also were trying to hustle anybody that they could in order to make some money. And the idea that they were pulled off of the train with these boys, they were about ready to be thrown into jail with them and charged with the Mann Act. But thinking quickly on their feet, they told a lie. And what's interesting here, which I find very dramatically very interesting, is what happens when you tell one lie. What's the chain of events that happens from that one point? And so when they tell this lie, it's an important moment in the piece. It's also it's a very telling moment how in history things can change, because not only do these boys, who were just regular people trying to survive in the Depression, suddenly become paraded into a national spotlight to stand for causes, to become the object of ridicule, to become the object of incredible misjustice by the criminal system, to be carried forward as superstars by the Communist Party. So many confusing different things. But out of this all, they just wanted to get work.
Mm.
And so I find that moment of what would happen when there are real people who are all of a sudden trapped this way, what happens to them? And the sad part of this is how their lives were changed, and in a lot of ways, they were not only destroyed, but have also been, in many ways, completely forgotten. But I do find that moment of that lie, what can happen and what can cascade from that, is really extraordinarily compelling dramatically.
Well, indeed, and that lie at that time in that place, obviously we're talking about men who faced death row for being accused of raping a white woman. I'm interested, from your perspective, you play Mr. Tambo. He's a white guard.
Yes.
And it's his job to guard the boys.
Absolutely. One of the things that in creating the piece with Coleman Domingo, who I worked with on the play at the Vineyard and at the Guthrie and on Broadway, one of the things we had to constantly think about was old school acting technique. How exactly do you want to make your acting partner feel?
Yeah.
So for us, as much as we could relate to the way they felt as black men, our job was really to determine how we wanted to make them feel as these white men. And there were times when I remember the first time I heard that beautiful song in the show, Go Back Home, I literally burst into tears.
Did you really?
And open weeping. And the difficulty was that right after that, I had to enter and give them the business. And so it was really, really difficult for me. One of the things I had to learn was how to keep my own feelings in check so that I could do what I'm there to do for them.
Well, you're an actor. I mean, you have to play roles. Is it hard for, seems like such a silly question, but is it hard for a black man to play a white man under the, you know, in this particular play?
It absolutely has its challenges. I would say, as I said earlier about making physical and vocal choices, that becomes the easy part. Emotionally, distancing yourself from what you know your fellow actors are experiencing, distancing yourself from what you know the other character is experiencing, really was a challenge at times, especially early on. I think that now it's something that obviously I have a lot more facility with, but
yeah,
real big challenge.
Well, and did you feel, and there's a piece of this that you're also lampooning these guys whose job it was to guard these Scottsboro boys?
Absolutely. And when I think about the lampooning, I try to come from the perspective of what it must have looked like to the boys trapped together in these cells. What this lawyer from New York, this northern liberal, what he must have looked like to them when he arrived in Alabama. And so that really, to me, is the source work of the lampooning.
Well, and I should say, and I do want to get to that, because you also play the lawyer, Samuel Leibowitz, who's hired by the ACLU, the Communist Party, to defend the Scottsboro boys. I do want to talk, though, about the electric chair, and I do want to play another song from the Scottsboro boys. But David Thompson, could you talk a bit about the fact that apparently when the boy, and I hate calling men boys, but nonetheless, when the Scottsboro boys were held in prison, they were held right close to where the electric chair was.
Yeah, and you know what? It's funny, they were boys, and the fact that two of them were 13 years old, and they were 13 to 19 in 1931 when they were arrested. So, you know, a 13-year-old is a 6th or a 7th grader, and that's how young they were boys. They were boys. But what they did was they kept them right next to the, in Kilby Prison, they kept them right next to where the electric chair was. And the guards and the took great pleasure in, they would have the electrocutions at midnight. And, of course, the idea of that is horrific, that there would be these boys who were innocent being in prison right next to this electric chair. They wrote, Clarence Norris wrote about how it would give him nightmares for the rest of his life, just the whole experience, the noise, the sounds, the smells. And so we take that idea, and it actually inspired Susan Stroman, the idea of what was that dream? What was that horrible moment? How did that translate into what that moment was like. And so we actually, at one point in the show, she does a tap dance around an electric chair. It's one of the boys having a nightmare, and it's done in sort of the style of one of those 1930s cartoons. Once again, taking a liberty from with the minstrel tradition to bring it to life, so that it's even more terrifying. But it was one of those things where the boys were continued to be dehumanized in every way possible in order to make them just not matter. They were just part of a cause or part of a trial, but not necessarily real boys.
And we are talking about the Philadelphia Theater Company's production of The Scottsboro Boys, playing at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Center City, Philadelphia, through February 19th. The voice you just heard is the librettist, and his name is David Thompson. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is one of the lead actors in The Scottsboro Boys, Forrest McClendon. Well, let me play one of the songs from this musical called Electric Chair. In fact, Forrest McClendon as a guard and the company from the 2010 original Broadway cast recording of the Scottsboro Boys. Let's listen.
Hey, little boy, look over there. That's what they call an electric chair. On that chair, put your ear, your hair frizzes out and your eyes disappear. It's a natural fact, I hear. Not every state got one of those. It can deep fry your skin, it can curl up your toes. It's a natural fact, God knows. Oh, the juice runs through you and you start to shake. It's a kind of tap dance, but you ain't awake. Just to hear that sizzling sound, people come from miles around. Mom and dad get crammed inside while the sunny boys electrify. It's so shocking, I declare, can't you? Glory be to our electric chair.
Dance! I said dance!
That's Electric Chair from the 2010 original Broadway cast recording of the Scottsboro Boys. And we are talking about the Scottsboro Boys today on Radio Times. Forrest, you had mentioned the fact that you got some of your inspiration for your performances in the Scottsboro Boys from cartoons. And if that didn't sound like a cartoon to me, no, I don't know what did.
Absolutely. Classic Bugs Bunny, yes. Right there. And I just love the idea that I think you hear in that particular scene why music is so successful sometimes in telling a difficult story. The music totally contradicts what's going on in the storytelling right there. You take a really horrible event and you musicalize it, and suddenly we swallow it just a little easier. And when it's over, we're like, did we really just swallow that?
Exactly. And I think the audience in part is saying the same thing as well, which is, am I laughing and clapping when I'm seeing something about an electric chair? And to you, David Thompson, is that part of what you want the audience to experience?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting dynamic when you pull an audience into a story and you actually make them slightly uncomfortable. They're never really sure what they're supposed to feel or how they're supposed to feel. They just know that they have to re-examine what they're feeling. And I think that, if anything, I have to say that it was something that we discovered after the show started playing to audiences. It would be nothing that you as an artist would be able to articulate before when you were creating the piece. It's a little bit abstract, but the interesting thing is when an audience is uncomfortable that way, they listen to things with a new ear, and that's very important when you're telling a story that you're asking people to reconsider maybe in a way that they haven't heard it before, so that at the end, when they leave, they have something to think about or talk about that they might not have felt coming into the theater. And I think that's actually been, and I know, Forrest, we've talked about this, and you've seen this as a performer. It's one of those things with this piece that I find very rewarding, because people don't know what to think when they're watching it. Sometimes they think they've figured it out. Sometimes they don't. But when they leave the theater, they oftentimes find themselves in very very meaningful conversations. It could be with the person next to them. It could be a white man talking to a black man. It could be people waiting and talking to the actors, people in the lobby. But there's this incredible conversation that gets generated, and I find that to be, more than anything, the rewarding part. You can hate the show or dislike the event of it or the idea of it, but it's very hard to ignore it. And I think that I find that very exciting.
And I'm wondering, too, as an actor, and you've been acting for quite some time now, Forrest, whether you can sense how an audience, almost like sense the room before the show starts, a show starts.
Absolutely. I think, for me, the genius of Susan Stroman is that there are so many things about her that are ingenious, but one of the great things is that we enter literally right down the aisles through the audience. So I'm literally no more than 2 feet away from people, and I'm looking directly in your eyes. I get a sense instantaneously of exactly how you're feeling. And I remember Susan Stroman at one point in the process saying that she needed to have an opening number that kind of allowed people to strap in for the ride, if you will. And during it, I get to look directly at the audience, tell them some jokes, and they think, oh, he's charming, he's funny, we like him. Well, I leave the stage and come back, and they don't like me so much anymore.
Okay.
And
yeah, because you're like a clown with a gun at
well,
that
I was going to say, yes, exactly.
So I feel that moment where they turn on me, but then they turn several times again. Mm-hmm. I come back and tell some more jokes, and they're like, well, we're going to laugh. We think we like him. I come back to save the boys. They're like, I think we really like him. But then there's a moment where their feelings towards me change, and they begin to have feelings amongst themselves and towards each other. You begin to almost judge the person next to you for what they find humorous.
Interesting. David, about a minute before a second break here, but it's interesting that the Scottsboro Boys closed after some 70-plus performances in New York and then gets 12 Tony nominations. What does that tell us about New York?
Well, you never know. I mean, it's that thing where you start a project and you commit to it, you do it, and then you have a wonderful time. We had a wonderful time off Broadway. We were at the Guthrie, and even when we were on Broadway, it was an extraordinarily rewarding experience. And it was one of those things that even though it had a very short run, it was very rewarding. And then we thought, well, you know what? That's what we were going to take away from it. But when it was nominated, it was one of those things where we recognized that people were still affected by it. And 6 or 7 months later, it was still there, and people were still talking. We thought, okay, that's interesting. And it was incredibly gratifying and actually kind of humbling.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the creation of the Scottsboro Boys and what it's like to perform in this musical. And again, the Philadelphia Theater Company's production of the Scottsboro Boys is at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia through February 19th. Talking with Forrest McLennan, he plays several roles, including one for which he got a Tony nomination, Mr. Tambo. Also with us is David Thompson, Tony-nominated book writer for the Scottsboro Boys. Stay with us. More conversation. More music after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Pathways PA supports WHYY. Pathways PA Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program provides free income tax assistance to those earning less than $50,000 a year. Information at pathwayspa.org or 800-209-2914.
I'm Marty Moscowane. It's the winter membership campaign, and I want you to become a member of WHYY. Why? Because we depend on listeners just like you to support the programs that you enjoy. It's just that simple. This year is going to be a busy one, and our job is to keep you informed about the news and provide in-depth analysis of the issues and the controversies. That's why you listen, and that's why we need your support. That phone number, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Penn State Law and universities from around the world premiere World on Trial, an international human rights courtroom television drama, Tuesday night at 6 and 9 p.m. on the Y Info Channel. Details at worldontrial.psu.edu.
Pathways PA supports WHYY. Pathways PA Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program provides free income tax assistance to those earning less than $50,000 a year. Information at pathwayspa.org or 800-209-2914.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and talking with David Thompson and Forrest McClendon about the Scottsboro Boys, the musical that's here in Philadelphia. And I do want to play another song, but let me go back to you, David Thompson, and talk a bit about this Samuel Leibowitz, who is hired to defend the Scottsboro Boys. And I should add that they have been gone to trial several times. They have been found guilty several times, some of them facing the death penalty as well. Who was Samuel Leibowitz and how did he get involved?
Samuel Leibowitz was a very well-known lawyer in the early 30s, and many thought he was going to become the next Clarence Darrow. And he was brought into this case by the Communist Party to defend the Scottsboro Boys. But the problem was, not only was he from the North, but he was also Jewish. So you've got these twin evils of racism and anti-Semitism all of a sudden colliding. And what was interesting about Leibowitz is he really felt and was committed to these boys to get them free. He was committed to making a difference, but he was soon going to become the object of all the same feelings of anti-Semitism, and that were going to really pull him out of the spotlight and almost destroy him. So, but at the top of this, when he enters, and Forrest plays this part brilliantly, yeah. He's coming in and he's going to win the case, and of course he's going to take it home for them, and that's not what happened.
No, it isn't. And can you talk about how you conceived of Samuel Leibowitz, Forrest?
Yeah, I actually, in terms of the research, I'd listened to an interview with one of his sons who talked about the fact that his father had this great baritone voice that he would use to marvelous effect, and how many people referred to him as a little bit of a showman. I remember seeing a clip of him arriving at court, kind of dashing up the stairs, almost at the moment before he needed to be in the courtroom, just in time for the photo op, if you will. And those became the kinds of characteristics that I would really wanted to blow up in terms of him, because again, it is lampooning. I believe, let me just say, that he absolutely was a hero, that were it not for him, many of those boys probably would have been executed immediately. Mm. But for me, it was more about the way the Southerners, as David was just saying, saw this man who was coming in from the North. That's the story that we're really telling. And I think
right.
That's the story of the circus that we were referring to earlier.
Well, let's play another song. And this is, again, from the original Broadway cast recording of the Scottsboro Boys. And it's a song called That's Not the Way We Do Things. And it features our guest, Forrest McClendon, as Samuel Leibowitz. Let's listen.
It's a whole new world up north, and by gum, it's time the South started seeing things our way, too. I was passing by to Water Mountain Saturday night. One was marked for colored only, and the other for white. Well, I know that that's the custom here in Alabama, but that's not the way we do things in New York. I was waiting in the courthouse for the trial to begin when I noticed in the men's room only white men came in. Well, I know that that's the custom here in Alabama, but that's not the way we do things in New York. Back in Manhattan, ask anyone. There's no bigger voice for equal rights than me. I fight for it. I live for it. Just ask my maid Magnolia, and I'm sure she'd agree. Let me say, the folks up north all want to show their support. So I'm here to help you through your trying hour in court. Although the law may be myopic here in Alabama, that is not the way we see things. That's not the way we feel things. That's not the way we do things in New York.
And And that's not the way we do things, featuring our guests, Forrest McClendon as Samuel Leibowitz from the 2010 original Broadway cast recording of the Scottsboro Boys. And Forrest, you use such a sort of broad accent. How did you come upon that accent?
I think I took the seedling of it from his son. Listening to his son's voice was the first door in, but then I wanted to mix in a little tiny bit of Cagney and a little bit of Jolson.
Right? Oh, interesting. Now, why Cagney and Jolson? Just to give it that little...
That real kind of bright timbre, and also something really indicative of the period is what I was after.
Right. And going back to you, David Thompson... And going back to this character, actually, one of the things that you said yesterday in talking about this production was that while Leibowitz and others were interested in getting the Scottsboro Boys out of prison, they also were using them to their own ends. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, at that time, in the early 30s, so many different causes were sort of beginning to surface. One of them in particular was the communist movement in America, and it was in the very early stages. But when... It became a rallying point for an enormous amount of people who were trying to survive the Depression. And what's interesting about that is when the boys were first arrested, hundreds of thousands of people gathered in New York as part of a communist movement, in the early stages of a communist movement to protest the trials. So I think they realized they had something here. It was that idea of people being marginalized and being destroyed, and how can we use these boys as part of that message, mm-hmm. that national narrative. And the Communist Party sees this case. In fact, it became sort of a pushing match between the Communist Party and the NAACP to see who could actually represent these boys. So you can see how there was that notion of larger causes at play here. And in a funny way, the boys were more helpful in prison than they were if they were ever to be freed, because suddenly the your rallying point disappears, and you no longer have that cause to fight for. So it's a very complicated idea, but it was something that that was true about the way the Communist Party sort of embraced the Scottsboro Boys. It became part of a national movement and even part of a worldwide movement. The mothers for several of the boys were on speaking tours, not only in the Soviet Union, but in Germany and different areas, in order to show how the Communist Party was fighting for everybody. It was a very interesting period of time that way.
Indeed. And there's also a song that talks about Jew money. And I know, David Thompson, part of your research was to look at court transcripts and to read books and to read accounts. Was there talk about Jew money in the courtroom?
Absolutely. What was interesting about it, Samuel Leibowitz, of course, comes down from the north to defend the boys. And the Attorney General in the South, his name was Thomas Knight. Actually, one of the girls who cried rape now comes back to recant and say that it didn't happen, but she's now also wearing nice clothes. And immediately, they assume that her change of heart has been purchased, and they start actually sniffing the Attorney General starts sniffing the room and talking about smelling money from New York. And the only kind of money they have in New York is Jew money. And it was actually one of the most... Dan Carter, who wrote an incredible book called The Tragedy of American South, said that this summation, this idea that there was Jew money in Decatur, where the trial was being held, was actually one of the reasons why the Leibowitz, despite the fact that he had the better trial and the better case, lost. Because Jew money all of a sudden became a rallying cry in that courtroom.
And
crazy idea. You can't make that stuff up.
No, you can't.
But it became something that actually took Samuel Leibowitz out and made him, that jury, decide that the boys were guilty again.
And that's David Thompson. He's the librettist of the Scottsboro Boys, and Forrest McClendon also with us, performing several roles, including Mr. Tambo in the Scottsboro Boys and the Philadelphia Theater Company's production of the Scottsboro Boys at the Suzanne Roberts Theater through February 19th. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times.
a fascinating conversation about some of the history and background on this production that if you end up being lucky and getting to see this, it will really inform the evening and really inform the performance. I'm Mike and Scott. With me here is Dave Davies, and it is our WHYY membership campaign, and we're hoping that you will be the next person to make a call at 1-888-345-9499 or online. You can pledge there as well at WHYY.org.
Yeah, this is that time of year, Mike, and where, you know, it's kind of like when the alarm goes off in the morning and you think, oh, gosh, do I really want to get up and do this? Well, yeah, three times a year we come together and we have to all pitch in to sustain this service. If you've been listening a while, you know how it works. And if you haven't pledged in a while, we'll hope that you will now express your support for our programs by making a call at 1-888-345-9499 or at WHYY.org. So easy, so quick, it'll make you feel great. You know, Mike in the last hour was reminding us that this is a time when there's a lot of stress on government budgets, and state funding, which had come to public broadcast entities like us, has disappeared. Federal funding is threatened. There is certainly a legitimate debate about how precious tax dollars ought to be used. But I think there's no debate that what we are providing is a service that is worth your attention and we believe worth a reasonable contribution. We don't even give you a number. We ask you to pick up the phone and figure out what it's worth to you. But it's so quick, so easy, and this is day one of our biggest membership drive of the year, and we really want to get off the dime quickly. And I will close by making the point that we only interrupt this hour of Radio Times once. You heard a long, interesting discussion of this fascinating portrayal of the Scottsboro Boys case on Broadway through this minstrel show, uninterrupted, so that we could come to you at the end here and say, okay, we're going to jump in now and take care of business. Thanks so much for that web pledge. Please join in at WHYY.org. or on the phone at 1-888-345-9499.
And Dave, it is also continuously important for us as a station, as WHYY, to expand our membership base. How many people who listen to the station are members? That's a question that is really starting to come up. Can you convert your listeners into members? Because otherwise, maybe your model isn't working. We believe in this model. It has sustained us for 50-plus years as a public radio station. But what really our challenge is as we grow our listenership, which we've been very successful in doing, and that's great news. We're happy that you're out there. But we also need to expand the base that we stand on, because otherwise we're going to become very top heavy. So we'll have a lot of people listening, but we only have a small base supporting. That's not a good model. So right now we're asking people, maybe you have never pledged your support before. Right now is a perfect time. It is the best time to make that call at 1-888-345-9499 or online at WHYY.org, because we can't rely on other people doing that. It really has to be a group effort. And if not you, then who? Who is going to pick up the phone? Is it going to be your neighbor? Does he have more money than you do? Is he better off? I don't know. You know, who is going to do it if not every one of us feels that responsibility for a service?
Right. Whenever we decide not to support something just because nobody's demanding it of us, we're letting somebody else pick up the load. And there are those of us in this tough economy who just can't afford it right now. And if you're in that situation, we understand. We thank you for being here as a listener and look forward to you joining. But if you can, it really is only fair that we all chip in together and sustain this service. You know, I look at today's show, Mike, and actors and playwrights and novelists are constantly writing Radio Times and Marty Moskowitz and saying, I'd love to get on your show. I have a terrific product. And most of them don't make it, because there is a very discerning staff of producers and editors who look carefully at this stuff, confer with Marty, and when they decide they're going to do something, they do it right. Marty went to this show. You can hear it. She understands it. She did research. She knows about the case. She knows about the actors and writers involved here, so that when the mic goes on, she's not sitting down and winging it. I mean, she is immersed in this and can bring things out which really make a rich conversation. One quick example, she talks about how the Scottsboro boys, and I didn't know this, all those years they spent in jail were placed deliberately adjacent to the electric chair so that they could get the sights and sounds of midnight executions, which left some of them with nightmares for life. The kind of detail that Marty brought out because she knew the story, because she was prepared. It's the kind of effort that we think is valuable, that we think is worth sustaining. I listen to the show. I listen to podcasts of the show because there's just so much terrific stuff. If you agree and you haven't donated lately, it's time, isn't it? Do it on day one of this membership drive. Get it done. All it takes is a quick phone call or a quick trip to your computer, and you will feel terrific. You'll get that feeling that says, I've done something that I ought to do. I'm going to feel good the rest of the day about it. The number is 1-888-345-9499. You know it by now. And, of course, at our secure website, whyy.org.
1-888-345-9499. Dave, there recently was a terrific story on our website, newsworks.org, about a local business. They had gotten in one of these Groupon deals and had really made a bad deal. They admitted it was their own fault. They hadn't thought it through. And they were almost gone. They were about to go out of business. And the whole neighborhood rallied around them and actually saved this store, right? And so many times, I was just thinking, we hear these stories of something is on the verge of disappearing, then everybody says, oh no, and they all come to the help. So here at Public Radio, that's not our model. We ask you, you know, we have our budget in mind, and we come to you and we say, look, this is our goal. Here's what we have to do so we can be safe and sound for another year. Because the last thing you ever want to hear is us going on the air saying, this is our goodbye broadcast. That would be horrific. So we plan these things out that we can engage in a solid partnership with our listeners, with our members, and that we know exactly, here's what we can bring you for the next year. Here's Fresh Air. Here's Radio Times. Here's News. Here's Newsworks. Here all are our services, and you make it possible. But we really have to meet these goals that we set for ourselves in order to get there. So you are that important partner in that equation, and that's why I'm asking you right now to think about everything that WHYY brings to your life, all the discussion, all the information, the inspiration you've gotten, the idea to read a book, to go see a movie, to go see a play, all of that, how important that is in your life, and then to make that pledge, whether you do like the person just did, Dave, by making a ping at WHYY.org or by calling 1-888-345-9499, no matter how you do it, as long as you get in touch with us.
Yeah, we do have ambitious goals for this drive because if you haven't noticed, we have been expanding our services. You know, as Mike says, everybody responds to a crisis. We want to make sure this place is strong and doesn't end up in a crisis. But beyond that, we've actually been expanding. If you compare the news production of this station to where it was 5 years ago, I think you're going to find that it is dramatically expanded. Newsworks.com.